This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're on remote. This is my favorite program of the year because I get to present the National Book Award winner, Marfield Prize for Writing in the Arts, given by the Arts Club of Washington, D.C. And this is a special book. There's a $10,000 prize, and it's the best nonfiction book in the country, competing against books in dance, photography, media, performing arts, painting, and its winner is Maggie Daugherty. And here she is. Maggie, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Grace. Thank you so much for having me.
Were you surprised to win?
I was shocked. Yes, I was really, really surprised.
Is this your first book?
This is my first book, yes.
Where are we going to go from here? There's nowhere to go but up.
Hopefully, yes.
Well, I would like everyone to see this book. Now, we're radio people, so I don't know if I'm going to hold it right.
That looks great to me.
Let's see. There you go. There you go. A beautiful book. Tell us the title and what it's about, Maggie Daugherty.
So the book is The Equivalence, a story of art, female friendship, and liberation in the 1960s. And The Equivalence was the name of a friend group. So it's about a circle of artists. It's about a group of two poets, Anne Sexton and Maxine Cumin, the writer Tilly Olson, the painter Barbara Swan, and the sculptor Mariana Pineda. And these women met in the early 1960s at Radcliffe, at a new institution that had sprung up called the Radcliffe Institute for Independent Study. And it was designed as this kind of experiment by the then president of Radcliffe College, Mary Ingraham Bunting, who wanted to see what would happen if we gave money, office space, access to university resources, and other material support to women intellectuals and artists. The artists had the equivalent of a PhD in their respective fields. And that's why this group of women who found themselves there and at the very start of the program called themselves the Equivalents. So the book is tracking their careers, their collaborations, both prior to meeting at Radcliffe and afterward, as a way of thinking a little bit about how art is produced in community, and also a little bit about women and creativity, both in the mid-century and kind of how that shaped how we think about these things today.
Yes, Maggie Daugherty, winner of the Marfield Award for Writing in the Arts, given by the Arts Club of DC. Well, it is about your book, interestingly enough, although literature is the forefront, does cover other arts too. So what did you learn about the other arts?
I learned so much. So yes, I have a background in literary study. That is definitely, you know, the water I swim in. It's what I write about as a journalist when I'm reviewing books and writing essays. I'm often writing about literature. So I felt really at home with the writers in this book. I understood their process. I understood what writing meant to them. The visual artists were like entering a whole new world for me. One of the things that really struck me was how physically laborious sculpting and even painting are. I didn't really have a sense of what it took to produce a full canvas worth of a portrait or a life-size sculpture like the kind that Pineda made. So it was really striking to me that in order to fund visual art, you actually need quite a bit of money. You need quite a bit of space, and sometimes you even need help from other people just to get the art together. You need studio assistance.
There is so much richness in this book, but I'm so glad that the centerpiece are Anne Sexton and Maxine Cumin, because actually these are the breakthrough poets for women like me. Really, they were in the 50s. They were mothers and wives. And, you know, we identified with them most. We didn't identify with Marianne Moore and Elizabeth Bishop. Mm. No, these are the women that were like us. And so we can't get enough of them. And you get details that were never known before. So tell us, when did you get this idea to do this book? What triggered it? And how did you proceed with this obsession?
Obsession's a good word for it. I think you have to be a little obsessive in order to spend a bunch of time in archives, in order to be sorting through all the papers that people have left behind. So the book came from a few different things in my life, I think. I started really thinking about it when I was a graduate student in English, and I was studying at Harvard. And so I had access to a lot of the material that came into the book. But I didn't actually know a ton about the Radcliffe Institute for Independent Study when I was a student. I knew about Radcliffe. I knew a little bit about some of the fellowship programs it has today. But I didn't know that it started, this particular institute, was a way to get married women with children back into some kind of creative or intellectual or scholarly career that they may have put on pause. That was a history that totally wasn't known to me. And I was interested in it in part because as someone who writes, as someone who's often friends with other writers, I'm so aware of both the material support that writers need and also the friendships that sustain any kind of creative work, that I was really intrigued by something like this that, you know, made clear how important community and resources were to artists. I was also living with a group of women. So I think that was a big thing for me. I was living in a house with three other writers. We were very close. We had very intense relationships. We sometimes didn't really get along. And I think in some way wanted to explore my own life, even though I'm not super present in this book, wanted to explore the world I was in and the life I was sharing with these women through this kind of model from a few decades ago.
And do you think that women together are an important community?
I think so. In my own life, that's certainly been true.
I have been very dependent. As a Navy wife, I was very dependent on other women. And even now, I find that the currency of energy between women artists is profound. I rely on it. Mm. And so you got this idea. But what was the day you said, I think I'll write a book and win a National Book Award?
That definitely was not a thought that occurred to me. But, you know, I put this idea, I think this happens a lot with writers and ideas. I had this idea before I actually had the chance to work on it. So I kind of had to put it on pause. So I found this group, I found this history when I was completing a PhD. And it was not really the kind of story that you can really tell in a PhD in academic writing, because it's so personal, or the way I wanted to tell the story had so much to do with who these women are, how they felt, what their friendships were like, what their family lives were like. And that's not really the stuff of academic scholarship.
I love that. I love that, because historians tell us what they did, but real writers tell us how they felt. And that is why this nonfiction book reads like fiction. It's delicious. It is so full of detail and so full of personality and passion. Did you get to like Anne and Maxine more as you went along, or did you find them annoying?
I think I started to relate to them the way I relate to everyone in my real life, which is with a lot of curiosity and a lot of empathy or sympathy. You know, I think even people you become quite close to, or maybe in a way, as you become closer to them, you realize how much of them you sort of can't know. You're knowing more about them, but you kind of recognize that there's still something that you don't fully understand. So you want to learn more. You want to read more about them. You want to get to know them better.
But do tell everyone, first of all, we're acting as if this is a members only club. Tell us, who was Anne Sexton and who was Maxine Cuman?
They were two poets who both lived in Newton. Anne Sexton might be the name that everyone might be familiar with, although I think Maxine Cuman's star has risen and continues to rise. She did, after all, become poet laureate. But Anne Sexton was a very surprisingly accomplished poet for someone who did not start writing poetry until she was 28. And when she did, she wrote amazing poetry. She learned how to do it just from watching an educational television program. And as soon as she was off to the races. So she right away found a lot of success. She was also someone who wrote confessionally. So she wrote a lot about her own life, her own struggles with mental illness, her feelings about being a woman, having a body as a woman. And so she became, even though she didn't really think of herself as a feminist, she became this really kind of groundbreaking poet, especially for women. And was a great performer. So she gave a lot of poetry readings. She was something of a literary celebrity. Mm. And her best friend was Maxine Cuman. also a poet, a very, very different poet, who wrote a lot about the natural world, who had a kind of Frost, almost Whitman kind of feel to her poetry. And she didn't meet with fame and success until later, until the 1970s, when she too, like her friend Sexton, won the Pulitzer.
Right. And they were on the phone every day.
They were. Yes. They had a method where they would sit down at their desks in their separate houses in Newton, pretty close to each other. And they would, one of them would call the other. They gossip a little bit. They talk about their family, what they were making for dinner that night. And then they would say, okay, let's get to work. And they would start writing right there on the phone. And when one of them had something she wanted to share, she would just whistle into the phone line and ask, you know, what do you think of this line? What do you think of this stanza? It's a really fascinating collaboration.
Unlikely couple to me. They're an unlikely couple. Yes. I mean, Anne Sexton, well, they both of them had mother issues, yes. But Anne Sexton was this voluptuous, luscious, sensual being. And Maxine was rather kind of an uptight, scholarly writer in the beginning. And then, of course, she was well known for her nature writing, but they were so very different. But don't you think that interdependency was the most unusual thing in the history of literature?
It's a really fascinating kind of interdependent and also very complementary of each other. I mean, both complementary, they loved each other's work, they really respected it, and they complemented each other really well. Heumann had studied at Radcliffe as an undergrad, she had a master's degree, and she had, as you said, a really kind of professorial understanding of poetry. She understood different genres, she understood different rhyme schemes, and she had a very technical understanding that Sexton came by a little bit more naturally. Sexton would sometimes joke that she didn't know what she was doing. She thought it was all kind of magic or a trick.
That's right. And it did sound like magic.
Yeah. And so she could turn to Max, you know, who she called her Max, and say, well, what am I doing here? Or is there something that explains what I'm doing? Or even when they used to give talks at the Institute together and she didn't understand a question about her own poetry, she would ask Heumann to explain it for her and say, you can explain what I'm doing here.
This is Maggie Daugherty, winner of the Marfield Book Award for Writing in the Arts for the book, The Equivalence. Well, I'm very interested in these two women, but I saw the background was all male, institutionalized male figures they had to come up against. Mm. And that was where poetry was in the 50s. And they actually were not always respected and tolerated and appreciated at first right away. Mm-hmm. A couple of the male moguls did not encourage them. So there was a little bit of feminist behavior that started there, I believe. And I do want to touch on this because although you have the arts as the center knot of this ribbon, it covers the whole feminist movement from the 60s. What was your most surprising thing about studying the women liberation movement?
That's a really great question. I was familiar with the story that I think a lot of us are, or the story that sometimes is shared about women's liberation, which is a woman named Betty Friedan wrote a book called The Feminine Mystique, and suddenly all these housewives understood that they were trapped, and they started to get together and try to make some changes.
And burn their bras. And they
Yes, exactly. So this is a very simplified story, but it's useful. There's reasons we think about that. But two discoveries that I made were, first of all, I had no idea that Friedan had a co-writer on her book. So Mary Ingraham Bunting, the woman who founded the Radcliffe Institute, was originally her collaborator. They were writing the book together. That was not something that I was aware of at the time. They eventually went their separate ways. Friedan wrote a book. Bunting founded the Institute. That was kind of fun and surprising to me. But I think it pointed out this bigger prehistory, maybe, of women's liberation, which is that I hadn't realized how in the 50s, there was so much awareness and discussion of what is the role of woman in America? How do we, you know, sort of educate women? There already was a lot of activity and advocacy and activism happening in the 50s, even before women were burning their bras or marching in the street. So part of what the book is about the beginning or origin of some of this political activity. even by women that didn't necessarily see themselves as political or even as feminist.
Yes. And the nuances and the friction and the separate factions in the women's movement is covered here very, I think, with a great deal of interest because it is so complex. How did you manage to take such a big thing and find your focus? I mean, here you had the whole women's liberation, in addition to the Radcliffe Institute, in addition to these individual lives, which you point out very clearly. How did your mind work? I mean, how did you whittle down what was important so that you did not lose the Bunting Institute?
It was a struggle, and I'm not sure that I got everything as smoothly integrated as I would have liked. I think looking back on it, maybe I wouldn't have my first book have five central life stories that all have to be told at once in the middle of history. But I think, you know, I kind of wanted to show the world they were in. That felt very important to me, that often the way an artist is creating art has a lot to do with what's going on at the time that they're creating it. And so it felt important to talk about their work, to talk about their lives in this broader picture of what else is going on in America, geopolitically, even in terms of foreign policy. The Vietnam War becomes a very big deal for Maxine Kuman later in her career.
Here it is, the National Book Award for Writing in the Arts for Maggie Daugherty. Her first book, her first of many, I know. Please give us a little taste of this book. Read us a bit of it.
Sure. So we've been talking a lot about Kuman and Sexton, and I wanted to read a little bit from a talk they gave at the Radcliffe Institute where they shared their poetry with the other women who were present in this group. On this February afternoon, the wan winter light coming through the windows, Sexton gave her own kind of writing lesson. If she could show these scholarly women anything, it was that the eye of a poem was not as simple or straightforward as they might think. Yes, she wrote personal poetry, she drew from her own life, but she often used another character, someone else that I wasn't, or that I couldn't have been, or that I imagined I was. Sexton was, in fact, remarkably insightful about poetry, but she lacked her fellow poet, Kuman's, analytical bent. She couldn't always explain why she'd made a given decision. It just looked right on the page, she would explain, or the image just came to her. Perhaps self-conscious about the almost anti-intellectual tone of her presentation, she excused and defended herself throughout the talk. "I'm afraid all my poems are fairly serious that I'm reading today," she said. "I'm sorry my poems are so serious." At one point, she apologized for apologizing. She closed her talk with The Fortress, her poem for Linda, her eldest daughter. It was her first time reading it in public. She described how she had gotten a ghastly backache while writing the poem because she'd spent days at her desk working straight from 8 in the morning until 11 at night. "I was working on it and my kids were running around and the cleaning woman ran in and out. Dinner wasn't ready and my husband came home, and that's no example of how you're supposed to act as a wife," she said apologetically. Kayo, her husband, had stolen a secretary's chair from his office the very next day. He understood her need to concentrate. It might not be the traditional behavior of a wife, but it was the behavior of an artist or a scholar. It was an experience that many women at the Institute would recognize. "It's for all of us," Sexton announced when the poem was over, "us mothers, the graduate mothers." The Fortress was the final poem that Sexton read that afternoon. 30 minutes after she started reading, she declared that the poets were done. The poets had revealed themselves to be two different people after all. "Turn off the tape," someone yelled, but the recording continued. Tea was passed. After some time, wine was poured. Sexton helped herself. "I don't really think a wine cellar makes an alcoholic necessarily," she said to no one in particular. Like an orchestra starting up, the audience came to life. Some directed questions at the poets, others engaged in side conversation. Someone complained about a local paper's coverage of the Institute. "We're not rusty mothers." Sexton and Kuman disagreed. They both had periods of latency. "We did get rusty," Sexton admitted. Now they were back at their desk. Their children resented them at times, but they also benefited from being exposed to art. Sexton's children, though young, knew what a poem was. "It's what your mummy types all day."
That is exactly the right definition of a poem. Yes. How did you find those intimate details?
So the tape that someone asked them to turn off in the passage that I read was a tape recording of this presentation that Kuman and Sexton gave. So a wonderful discovery I made, or you know, a thing in the archive that the wonderful librarians at Schlesinger Library had preserved for me, were tape recordings of all the presentations that were given at the Institute. And tapes are amazing. I mean, here we are on the radio talking. You can hear the tone of our voice. You can hear the sound of me opening the book. You have a sense of sort of emotion and atmosphere that is harder to find, I think, in written documentation. So finding these tapes and using them was really, it allowed me to hear what Sexton's voice sounded like when she read a poem. It allowed me to hear.
Deep voice.
Exactly.
How many tapes do you think you listened to?
I listened to maybe 10 or 15 because this was I was just listening to the earlier years of the Institute where this is when the women in my book were there. So it's the early 1960s. So I used the tapes and then I also was able to look at their letters. I looked at their applications to the Institute where they wrote about their dreams and ambitions for themselves. And of course, I was looking at all of their published writing and visual artwork that they had.
So you read, of course, you've read every book they've written.
I have, yeah, at this point.
I'm sure you have. So you will become the chief biographer by default at some point.
Well, there are some wonderful biographies of some of these figures as well. So I should give credit to some biographers who've also done that work.
This is true. But how many pages do you think that you wrote before you came to this 300-some page book?
Yeah, I wrote probably about another 50% worth of that book that didn't make it into the final version.
People don't know. People do not understand the art of discard.
I think one thing that I thought when I started this book is that people weren't actually going to want to hear that much about poetry. And this is maybe, this is my fear, you know, that this is sort of niche. It's not something that general readers want to read about. And so I'd stuffed the book full of a lot of history because I said, well, history is important, you know.
This will make more people want to read poetry. I think it will.
I hope. Well, so that's what ended up happening. So when I wrote the first draft of the book, it had a lot more history in it, you know, historical events and things like that. And then my editor read it and she said, well, what about the poetry? We really need, these were poets. We want to hear more about the poetry and more about your thoughts on the poetry. And so that was the major part of the revision for me, was actually bringing the art much more, making the art much more central to the book and showing how important it was in its own right.
Did you offer a proposal to a publisher? Did you pitch it? Did they come to you? How is it? And aren't they glad they did?
I hope so. I did write a proposal for this book. And because it was my first book, it was a pretty substantial proposal. I think it was 100 pages. So it was something that I worked pretty hard on to get out.
Just one publisher?
To a few, maybe 12 or 13 or something like that.
People do not know the inner workings of an award-winning author.
I did not know.
Please read us another piece of the book.
Sure. So
The equivalence.
Anne Sexton is probably the person in this book who had the most friendships with the most characters. So Maxine and Anne Sexton were very close, but she was also very close with the writer Tilly Olson. So I'm going to read a little bit about Tilly Olson's experience at the Institute. Just lost my place during the first reading, but I will find it just in time. Tilly Olson was a working class writer from San Francisco. She came to the Institute at age 50 and she felt really out of place. So this is a little bit about her experience being at the Institute as everyone is getting excited about Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. But there were women who didn't thrill to Friedan's message, including the working class writer Olson. At first, Olson found herself persuaded by parts of The Feminine Mystique. During the weeks that the Institute buzzed with news about Friedan's polemic, Olson, preparing her seminar presentation, thought she would talk on women specifically. The Olson household might have been radical, but it was also very much of its time. In so many ways, Jack was an incredibly supportive husband. He helped out around the house and he deeply respected his wife. He thought of her as a comrade. But nonetheless, Olson found herself responsible for the bulk of the domestic labor. If the kids were sick, that was mom's problem, Julie, Olson's second daughter, remembered. Meals were mom's problem. Laundry was mom's problem. And there were four of us. And like Friedan, Olson believed in the value of creativity. She abhorred all obstacles, social, political, economic, that got in the way of creative expression. Maybe there was something in all this chatter about women's lives and losses that she could use. In the end, though, Olson couldn't sign on to Friedan's project. For her, as for her husband, the true struggle was the class struggle. Looking again at the feminine mystique, she decided she didn't see herself in Friedan's pages. Who were these women who stayed home all day, listlessly vacuuming? In the Olson family, women worked, period, or you couldn't pay the rent, Julie explained. Like the narrator in I Stand Here Ironing, her award-winning story from 1957, Olson longed for more time at home with her daughters and for the energy to enjoy that time. I was a young mother, I was a distracted mother, the narrator of the story says at one point, thinking about the early years when her eldest daughter was small. We were poor and could not afford for her the soil of easy growth. At once a confession and a defense, I Stand Here Ironing communicated powerfully the plight of the working class mother, a woman trapped not by the feminine mystique, but by the wage labor that writers like Friedan thoughtlessly portrayed as always emancipatory.
There is so much richness in this book. There are so many layers, and they are each so lyrical, so clear and clean and beautifully written. We have the class struggle. We have so many personal involvements and quarrels really later on between the women, sometime about finances, some hurt feelings, and there were illnesses. This is not an award-winning book for writing in the arts. It is a work of art.
That's
very nice. I gobbled it down like peanuts, like eating peanuts. It's a page-turner.
That's great to hear.
Scholarly, you're going to give scholars a good name, Maggie. Because we're kind of scared of them. So finally, before we close, just tell us, what is it like to be a scholar? What does it mean?
Yeah. I completed my PhD.
What was your thesis?
It was on the National Endowment for the Arts. It was on state funding for writers after 1965. So I think there's a connection here, which is that I'm interested in how writers make a living. I'm interested in how writers make it work. It's a very hard road often being an artist.
Well, we're going to watch this non-fictionalized in The Atlantic, I'm sure The New Yorker or one of those. And what is your new book going to be about? Because we know there is a secret index card already in your pocket.
Oh my gosh. I have been so excited about this first book that I have not had a chance really to think about what's next. But in the meantime, I'm writing a lot of essays. So I wrote about the poet Adrienne Rich recently. I'm writing about the writer Shirley Jackson right now. And I'm looking forward to writing about the writer Elizabeth Hardwick. So I will be really learning a lot and thinking a lot about women and writers going forward.
We are going to watch your meteoric rise with all of our hearts. Thank you so much. That was the voice of Maggie Daugherty, winner of the Marfield Book Award for Writing in the Arts from the DC Arts Club. And this program is The Poet and the Poem. It's produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family and Avi Deshashani. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.